Okay, welcome everyone. I am Sue Trinidad, the Director for the National Centre for Student Equity in Higher Education. We're very pleased to have Professor Alex Jung here for 2 days visiting our centre. And we were just talking about his TED talk. As a TED speaker, we're very honoured to have him here. So I knew him quite well, having come across his TED talk, and then managed to meet Joe. So all of the circle was complete, and now it's been wonderful to have the two of them here today. But before I go much further, I just forgot my very first bit, which was I needed to pay our respects to the Indigenous members of our community by acknowledging the traditional Noongar custodians of this land that we meet here today on, and that's Elders past and present. Now, Alex is the author, From Here to the University, Access, Mobility and Resistance Among Urban Latino Youth. Alex, thank you very much, because you have quite a broad set of experiences here, having worked in a number of universities, and in particular we're very interested in what you've got to say about your work in Cambodia, as you've conducted research on issues surrounding higher education globalisation in the Pacific Rim, and you've also been teaching courses on diversity and social justice in higher education. And so we're going to have a chance here to hear about the qualitative study which utilised ethnographic and narrative inquiry approaches and explored the lives of a dozen Cambodian students and their educational life and life experiences, and looking at their journeys from an orphanage to college, which we've been talking about today, and some of the issues that our disadvantaged youth have. And so there's a lot of comparisons that we can make, and we're looking forward to future research with Alex and his team. So I'm going to hand over to you now, but welcome, and thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It is a privilege to be here, and I love being associated with the Centre. Thank you for the invitation. And I'm going to launch into some of the work that I've been doing with Cambodia. It was probably 15 years ago. My dissertation that I turned into a book was a study of first-generation, low-income Latino students in downtown Los Angeles, in a high-poverty, high-crime, gang infestation, and how did these students get their way through the streets of L.A. and into high school and then into college and then to graduate. And so that was a book that I'd worked on. And I always wanted to go back to that whole model, but look at it from a different perspective. And that's what led to this study in Cambodia. So it's an extension of the work that I did previously on disenfranchised youth. It's just a more of a comparative international look at this particular population. And so, you know, it's an honor for me to be here, and I'd love to share with you as much as I can share, not just my perspective, I want to share the student's perspective with you. So here's a story of someone I've named Samat, who is 20 years old now. Samat says this: I grew up in Mongolkiri, it's a province in Cambodia, where my family were farmers. There were times when we had many difficult times finding food, so I remember days when all we ate were pickled chili peppers. We survived by eating snakes, crabs, frogs, grasshoppers, crickets, and anything we could catch. One day, I was around 5 years old, my mom decided that she would move to the capital city, Phnom Penh, to look for a job so that she can prepare for a better future for my family. When I moved to the city, my life changed in many ways. My mom had married again, his father had died. Unfortunately, her new husband was really abusive to me. Almost every day he got drunk and he would beat me. I'll pause here and just say that Samat was then left alone. His mom and dad wanted to be together, so they sort of just left him. And so he was on this area in Phnom Penh, trash dumps, where a lot of disenfranchised students and sort of children just sort of live. And in that context, I met someone from Cambodia's Future, which is what I'm calling this organization, and I started a new life in the orphanage. Samat goes on to talk about his journey of what it's like to live, going from picking up trash and chasing around other children and playing to being housed and fed and ultimately educated by this organization. It's a non-governmental organization that works in Cambodia, a lot of NGOs in Cambodia. What I'd like to do today is talk a little bit about the organization, talk about the students as well and their journeys, and talk about their resilience. And then offer some recommendations for us as we think about what it means to partner with other organizations, for those of you who have an interest in this area on equity and access and mobility in higher education, for the most disenfranchised of students. There's a lot of things for us to consider, and so this is a program that I thought was interesting when I had first gone to Cambodia and met different organizations. This particular organization seemed to have a lot of the elements to it, but I'd love to discuss it with you all and then certainly leave enough time for questions. Okay, so talk about a framework for college access, understand how education institutions can collaborate with NGOs, and then finally some thoughts on future policy for this organization. Because no organization is perfect, I think we learn what to do and what not to do. So I'll share, try to be balanced and fair in my assessment here. For those of you unfamiliar with the Kingdom of Cambodia, a couple things to consider: in Southeast Asia, bordered by Thailand, Vietnam, and Laos. The official language and the ethnicity is the same. It's Khmer is the pronunciation, I think, because of 90-plus years of French colonization, they've taken a Francophone version of Khmer, which is Khmer, how the French decided to pronounce Khmer. But it is Khmer. It's both the language and the people. And it's about 90% Khmer, and a real mix of some Vietnamese and Chinese. So there's some multiracial, biracial groups, but everyone identifies mostly as Khmer. Probably most famous with Cambodia would be in the mid-70s. Pol Pot thought that he would do what took Mao Zedong in China in the Cultural Revolution 10 years to do. Pol Pot wanted to do in 1 year, was to change society into a social society. And so from 75 to 79, which was not too long ago for most of us, right? He was part of Khmer Rouge in his organization. Genocide of nearly 2 million people were killed, primarily the intelligentsia, teachers, professors, doctors, lawyers, etc. Anyone who wore glasses were killed. He was famous for saying this, "I'd rather have 10 innocent people die than one guilty person go free." And this is part of the reason that with the genocide for and fratricide, if you will, for his own people. And Cambodia, interestingly enough, is one of those countries because maybe they didn't have the war in Vietnam, for example, where a lot of other countries were involved. Cambodia was sort of left on the side, under-recognized and in many ways undervalued country. So from 74 to 79, with these atrocities that happened, in the wake of all that had happened, what was left, right? The educational system was eradicated, essentially. What is famous, if you've ever been to Cambodia, Phnom Penh, they have a high school that was used as a torture chamber to interrogate, to kill their prisoners. The Killing Fields is probably another famous landmark in Cambodia. But the entire system shut down. No education, no universities. And so how do you recover from it? Who teaches the classes in the 80s, right? They had to borrow, they had to bring faculty from Thailand and Vietnam and other countries, expatriates who left Cambodia to go to France and Australia. Some repatriated and came back to teach, but you know, it was in shambles. And they needed to come up with a system. What system were they going to use? So this is an ongoing issue right now. Low literacy rates, widespread poverty, government corruption. It's this sense of survival, collectivistically speaking, ongoing sense of survival. Along with government corruption, ongoing challenges with reliable public services. Sex trafficking has been in the news a lot in Cambodia. Human trafficking in general, not just women, but young children and now men into different industries, fishing industry, etc. Ultimately, a conversation for me from an educational perspective and talking about equity is this population of disenfranchised youth. And the statistics are not always reliable. I heard that 50% of the population, you know, under the age of 30. Right? What was noticeable in the time that I lived in Cambodia, there are very few people over the age of 60. Right? And you can understand why, historically, why that would happen, that there's very few people who are sort of in the older sunset ages of their lives in Cambodia. So, ongoing challenges, access and attendance, high school dropout rates, really high, low student enrollment, and of course, low rates of college participation. It's hard for someone like myself, who's a professor of higher education, who cares very much about access and equity, and sees higher education as the natural platform for not just for the public good, but for your own life, to see the low rates of college participation, low rates of high school participation, for that matter. And we're talking about the city in Phnom Penh, but if you go to the countryside and the provinces, it's much worse. Right? So it's an ongoing challenge that they have here. Part of my research was with a team, and then I moved my family to Cambodia, and we lived there for 3 years. So my research design is ethnographic in its nature, sort of prolonged engagement, extended period of time in the country. I spent the first year learning Khmer, my children were enrolled in the school system, the very school that, my participants went to school. So there's an interesting overlap in terms of prolonged engagement and participant observation. For those of you familiar with ethnographic methods, I think that's a very important element of research design. Also employed some grounded theory approaches, so coming up with conceptualizations and theoretical frameworks of how to understand based on the findings. But ultimately, it was a study of narratives. It was their own stories, their own journeys, from the past to current, future, trying to get an understanding of what their hopes and dreams were, and ultimately what their experiences were, so that we can draw from their own experiences to understand how we can set policy. I love this quote. It's Clandon and Connolly, who are narrative inquiry scholars. A collaboration between researcher and the participants over time in a place or series of places in social interaction. And it's that social interaction that I thought was really important, that I was living among the participants and building trust. I think there was an important element of this research design. Ultimately, what we ended up with all of our individual interviews, there are about 35 students or participants from high school and college. Primary focus for me was on this subset of five. I had a colleague of mine, a doctoral student at the time, Jacob Gross, wrote his dissertation on another population of students. So this is an ongoing multi-year research project that we are engaged in. The 35 students were primary, but we had secondary and tertiary interviews that included administrators, teachers, counselors, and then these group homes, ultimately, boys' homes and girls' homes. And they had people overseeing these homes. And so interviewing them, they're a critical element of their journey. Fairly standard approaches with our design, participant observation, a lot of document analysis, and prolonged engagement, as I mentioned earlier. Here's an overall view of the structure of Cambodia's future. It's an NGO that has been there probably in like the early 2000s was when the organization started. And what happened was, one gentleman was in the country, and this is fairly common, I think. What happens is, his heart was broken. He saw these students, these children everywhere, just displaced, and he thought, I've got to do something. So he adopted this group of children and just took them in. He and his wife, and he had four or five children of his own. And he brought them in, and he brought in about 30, 40 of them initially. And housed them, clothed them, fed them. And then ultimately, he started with this homeschooling, which he was doing with his own children, and it was just became unmanageable. So he got with some other organizations and said, what can we do? Can we start a co-op? Started doing a co-op, homeschooling kind of approach. Eventually, it turned into what we're calling AGAPE, the Greek word for love, AGAPE International School. That was primarily intended for as an orphan school for most of these students, and then he sent his own children to this school. But that's how it emerged. That's AGAPE International Academy, and now it's a fully accredited, WASC-accredited international school in Phnom Penh. So again, my children went there, other expats would go there. It's 50-50 expats and then Cambodian nationals, which is an interesting mix, I think. And of course, ultimately, the school's purpose was for these disenfranchised youth, the orphans. everyone wore uniforms, as is fairly common in a private school, an international school. So you couldn't tell who was who, which I think was an important distinction to sort of have. They had the super rich, and then they had the disenfranchised. So it was a nice mix, I thought. And then, of course, the expatriates all mixed in together. House of Peace and House of Strength is the schools that I, the homes that I've named for the boys' homes and the girls' homes, right? They were orphanages, essentially. And then you have the local administration. So Cambodia's future sort of was a funding arm. It's based in the United States, the organization itself, administration, central administration. Two other that I have in yellow here that are important to note is the feeder schools. They had, it's pretty popular in Cambodia. If you can start a private preschool, right, or a kindergarten, it's a revenue generator. There's so many children that they started several preschools, and that became a funding arm to help support the school. I'm going to talk about tuition here in a minute. Ultimately, the goal for these students was not only housing, feeding, and clothing them, but educating them. If they can graduate college, high school, this organization said, we will find a way to get you to college, and we'll pay for it. So they had this very, very important element of high school scholarships, college scholarships, to get these students through college. The caveat was, and the vision for the institution, was to have these students graduate from college, return to their own country, and then become leaders, future leaders of their country. So very bold plans. And I'll give you some numbers here in a second. So Cambodia's future was organized around these two boys' homes and girls' homes. One particular family, who I'm calling the Guardias, the founders of the organization, had this vision in mind. And eventually, as is common, I think, as the organization grew, the organization actually asked this family, the Guardias, to leave. And there was some conflict, I think, internally. But the founders of the organization are no longer part of it, which on one level I think is important to note, right? That it's not based on charismatic leadership alone. There's something valuable about the saga that's left behind with the organization and the culture. But the institution continued to survive, and I think that's an important element, that it's not based on one person's desire or dream, no matter how, again, how charismatic the person might be. I think it's important to note that the institution has to have belief in the system. And that's one thing that I noted here. But very structured. They were intentional about having high standards for the students. And I think that was an important note. When you look at, when we talk about equity students, when we talk about disenfranchised youth, and I talk about this in my own research with students of color, that it's funny that the first thing that you notice is you can't feel sorry for somebody that you haven't met yet, right? I mean, that's a problem. If your first instinct is to feel sorry for someone and you haven't met them, right? Somehow you lower your standards, right? There's a difference between compassion and pity. And I think these are some of the things that I was learning in interacting with these students, is they could tell the difference between compassion and pity. And part of that was, did you have high standards for me? Did you demand of me what you would demand of your own children, right? And that was an important element to this, that it wasn't simply, well, we'll give you a pass. They had this thing that they started early because students hadn't been in school for many years. They had catch-up school. So it was very intense early on. They wanted to get to grade level. But they may have been 2, 3, 4 grade years behind. Right? So you had to get them caught up. And that took tremendous amount of rigor and expectations on them. In addition, they had daily chores. A lot of the students did not speak Khmer very well. And so they had Khmer lessons, but also ESL. Part of the challenge, and I'm going to talk about this later, is the organization, as I said earlier, is an American-based, U.S.-based NGO. And I can appreciate that, that their perspective was very U.S.-centric. So they were thinking, universities, where would we send them? Where would you go if you're from America? You'd send them to an American university. So that was part of the goal. And most of the conversation and the learning in the school certainly were all in English. I'll talk more about that in a second. Okay, so I talked about academic rigor and high expectations, right? The goal that they set for these students, for these orphans, was you're going to graduate from college, and you're going to get these great jobs, and you're going to come back and serve your country. I don't underestimate the significance of that, right? Possible selves, right? Having high expectations of yourself and having others expect this of you, I think is very, very important. I think about that in the context of privileged students in the United States, you know, third and fourth generation college, parents are well-to-do, professionals, etc. College is the natural next step. In fact, we're already talking about grad school. In my circles, with my professional colleagues, we're not talking about college graduation. We're talking about what med school, what law school are you going to go to, right? What PhD program? Is it going to be in humanities? Is it going to be in sciences, right? The level of expectation is already higher, right? And yet when we talk about certain populations, we think, we hope you can get to college. We hope you can graduate high school, right? There's something very interesting and very subtle about that lowering of expectations for some, but holding what we would call normal standards for others. So I think that was an important element. Currently, where we are right now, of the 35 students who are part of this original cohort, 10 have graduated from college, various universities, US, Thailand, India, for example. 15 still currently enrolled. And 5 students are still at the secondary level. So if you're good at math, you realize, okay, what about the other 5 students? I think the reality of this is no matter how much they tried to implement this, some students just stopped out, dropped out, didn't finish at various stages, right? And so I think that's an important reality, that not every student, it's not this panacea that's going to cure all of the social ills, even with this population of students that they worked very, very closely with. The numbers aren't very large, 35 students, right? As I shared earlier with you, the challenges that we have in Cambodia, right, with the thousands of students, tens of thousands of secondary age students who don't have access to good education, right? This is a very small number. I'll talk a little bit about that more. Of the 10 students who've graduated, 10 have come back. That's controversial as well, in one sense, because is there any way to guarantee that these students come back to Cambodia? Well, part of the challenge is if you went as an international student, which they would be if they went to the United States or Thailand, you have to go back. I mean, you have a visa for a certain set period of time, and they have to return to their home countries. Let me talk a little bit about high expectation. This is from SoCal. They wanted us children to compete academically. Mr. Gardia pushed us hard, and he taught us that anything is possible. And is the examples that I gave earlier is, what do you want to become? You want to be a doctor? You want to be a nurse? You want to be a teacher? Right? And in their circles, most of the students in their communities with their backgrounds were either going to be trafficked, or they would have menial jobs, or just beg on the street. Right? So you can't underestimate the significance of having this statement of, you want to be a social worker, a teacher, some sort of professional degree. And then a little more, Soka talks about rules and expectations such as study before play, and were widely understood amongst the kids. And that was well established in terms of high expectations, which is great. Okay, a little bit more about agape. As I mentioned earlier, pre-K through 12, about 500 students were enrolled, and about 123 of them hold Cambodian citizenship. This is probably the high school level. And lots of nationalities represented. Tuition, by Cambodian standards, is expensive, $3,000 US, right, annually for tuition. Not so bad, probably, for the United States. In Australia, that doesn't sound like a lot of money for private education. But they revenue of $145,000 from not just the K-12, but as I mentioned earlier, this revenue streams of the pre-K and the kindergarten, which is interesting. Okay. They were very intentional, not just providing free tuition for the Cambodian orphans, but then, you know, if you start to understand the students who started coming to the school, their parents were tuk-tuk drivers, or, you know, they had one of those noodle carts. They were not, I mean, they had parents, they had both sets of parents, but they were just as disenfranchised economically. So the school started to change, and they started to not just bring in disenfranchised youth orphans, but they had low income, right? And so it's nice to see this organization sort of change in that regard. I mentioned earlier full tuition for college, and the part of the caveat was then to return to live in Cambodia. Talked about catch-up school. So the organization had lots of benefits And a lot that we can learn from in terms of how you can implement a school that's similar. But let me talk about one challenge. And this is an interesting one for me, because I love the organization, and I love the work that we're doing, but this idea of heritage, language, and culture, that was lost. I'd mentioned to you earlier that I'd spent a year, first year there, of my three, learning the language. And by the time I got to the students and I was trying to converse with them, I had to get IRB approval, right, Institutional Review Board approval to work human subjects. And by the time I was able to work with them, I realized that in many respects, my Kamaya was just as good as theirs. And it's interesting now, because they are 100% Cambodian citizens, Khmer, but their language fluency in their own language, in their own home country, was lost. Part of that was because they were learning ESL. Another part was their school was all in English. And third, the people who were in the House of Strength and the House of Peace were all Westerners, North Americans. That could be problematic for some, right? So this idea of cultural integrity that I've written on before in a previous context with, as I mentioned earlier, low-income Latino youth in the United States, this idea of enforcing a certain language and culture. Samat had this to say. So they forced us to speak English, but we still speak Khmer to ourselves. But when we saw them coming, we stopped, pretend like nothing happened. Hey, what's up? They would start speaking the language. It was tough at first. Like, we were not happy at all. Like, hey, why can't we speak Khmer? That's our language. It's a version of hegemony, some can call it post-colonial. It's this ongoing challenge of maintaining cultural integrity. And the challenge, I think, is this idea of divorcing oneself from your culture and your language for the sake of education. And I think that's a challenge. And this extends beyond Cambodia. And this is an issue that we're struggling with in the United States with students of color. Maybe an issue here as well with equity students. And so that may be a good point for us to have a discussion. But it's certainly something that we should consider. I'm going to wrap up here and talk about some implications for what it means for other organizations that want to start something like this. And this organization that I'm introducing to you all, pretty well established in Cambodia. And so many NGOs come in to Cambodia today, and they want to do the same thing. And what my policy recommendation is, please talk to organizations that have gone through what you've gone through. Don't work in isolation. Don't work in a vacuum. Try to work with other organizations that have done this. One of the biggest benefits, obviously, is financial. It's a reality. If you're first-generation college, if you're low-income, or in this case, completely disenfranchised, if you're orphans and you have no funding, it's a financial reality. But it's not just the money. It's housing, it's travel, it's everything associated with things that people with money don't think about. So there's a financial reality that has to be built in. Community is another important element that people would be committed. Now, I'm not a psychologist, I have colleagues who I've talked about this with. This idea of having a population of students that are disenfranchised and they lost their parents, they're going through grief, they're going through guilt, they're always bereaving this. And then they have a new population of mentors who love them, who want to be there with them, until their time is up, and then they leave. And these students are then left with a lot of emotion issues to say, well, I don't want to trust anybody. So there's a whole other set of literature, I think, that I'd love to go down. But either you react by saying, I'm going to love anyone I see, and I'm going to be close to them, it's a sort of an attachment disorder, or I will never trust an adult again, right? So this is some of the things that they were going through, that these students were going through, because they needed a sense of community. So I think it's this idea of long-term commitment, or another way of looking is being very clear that it's not about you. And that's a challenge with, I think, volunteerism or some of the social work that goes on in a place like Cambodia, especially with Westerners and folks from developed countries, from the global north. That's an ongoing challenge. Ultimately, I think maintaining this shared vision, what is the end goal, right? And knowing that housing students and clothing them and educating them has to have an end goal. And I appreciated this organization in that. They said, we want you to come back to your country and to serve your country. Trying to be balanced here. The other side of this was, you can't really serve in your own country if you don't speak the language. Mm-hmm. Now, you look like us, but you're no longer like us. You're really you're like white kids trapped in a Cambodian body, really. And that their mentality and their thinking was much more westernized. That works with this population of students and this, you know, with people who understood them, but if had they gone to the United States, they would be seen as Cambodians, right? Who spoke English pretty well, but they weren't necessarily Americans. It's another talk for another time. We can talk about that. But that's part of the challenge, is the shared vision of understanding how do you maintain cultural integrity? How do you maintain heritage, language, and culture, and not have that be divorced with high expectations? That's a subtle difference, I think, for Cambodia, that we would assume that if you're going to be well-educated and articulate and all of that, that you're somehow less Cambodian, right? And so that's an important element that I really wanted to focus on. And in the process of finishing a book right now with Jacob Gross, who I mentioned earlier, and we're compiling all of our resources and trying to put this together to tell a story and talk about implications for practice. Okay. Final recommendations as we move forward, recognizing this organizational saga, right? It's what I mean by that is it's not one person centered, and it cannot be driven by one charismatic leader. The entire organization needs to buy into it, and it has to be bigger than any one person's vision. I mentioned cultural integrity, and I'd love to talk about that more. And ultimately, though, any one program, or even 100 of these programs, doesn't get to the systemic change, right? You still have to work with the government. You still have to work on significant systemic changes within a structure or an organization. Otherwise, I'm afraid that there will always be this very interesting relationship with host country and NGOs that it's always a benefit. I mean, if you're going to use your money and your resources and your people to help, great, keep doing it. Hopefully it'll last forever. David Brinkley wrote a book called Cambodia's Curse, which I think was really interesting. It came out in 2011, 2012, I think, talking about how Cambodia has become an NGO factory, in essence. And controversial in that some of the things he said, not very popular. But he addresses this very issue of how do you get to systemic change? How do you work within the institution and the government and the people that are in place, as opposed to always doing add-on programs? In many respects, you know, some of the things that I've been talking about today are the symptoms of a larger problem. And we're still addressing just the symptoms and not the deeper underlying issues. So we're, in one sense, it's on my more cynical days, I said, we're just building better Band-Aids. We're just trying to study how to build a better Band-Aid, but we never get to the deeper underlying systemic issues. So I'm going to stop here and give us a chance to ask questions and have any reactions to make sure not to sit down.
I'm sure there will be plenty of questions.
Does the Cambodian government have some sort of registration program for or registration process for organizations involved in education?
Yes, they do. They have, when I was doing my research on a couple other projects that I was doing for higher education, because I'm looking at privatized higher education and how it was like the Wild West. New universities popped up everywhere. And the Ministry of Education and Youth Sports had an organization, and the Higher Education Commission had an organization. There were about 7 different agencies that if you wanted to follow the proper protocol, there were 7 agencies that you had to get permission from. They didn't have computer records, so it was a challenge that information wasn't centralized. And you know, I think you get a lot done by paying fees, you know, up front. And those are some of the problems. Yeah. But those are on my more cynical days, I think, of well, this is why people just start things on their own, right, without getting any permission. In fairness, the government absolutely cares about their citizens. And what they wanted was, what they didn't want was organizations coming in this case, and having students lose their cultural identity and lose the language.
I was just wondering, is there anything in that registration process about cultural maintenance?
Yeah, that's a harder issue, I think, because the government then would assume, because this would actually be true in the school that I'm talking about. A lot of rich Cambodian businessmen would send their children to this school because it's international and it's in English, and so there's certain soft power that comes with language, that everybody wants to go to an international school and be fluent in English because they had more opportunities. Even with both sets of parents, etc., and having a lot of money, these students, their English is better than their Khmer. And so at what level then does the government get involved? Do they shut down all international schools? Is it going to be enforced to have bilingual education? Right, that'd be an interesting approach. California, where I'm from, has struggled with that, with Spanish English and Mandarin and English, or the representative in Korean and English. Canada may have something to say about that, about bilingual education. Yeah. So, welcome to the club, Cambodia. This is an ongoing struggle, and there's no easy solution.
I'm interested in the 10 that came back. Were they more employable? Do you know what happened to them?
Yes, good question. Yeah.
Because they've been trained in a system that's different to the Cambodian system. So
that's right.
They come back, yes, they've got international education, but do they fit?
I think everyone took a little bit of little bite of humble pie. The organization realized that coming back to your home country and being a leader of the country doesn't happen when you're 23.
Yeah.
So maybe a few more years. It's going to take a while. But if that was ingrained in their head, which is a good thing, you come back at 23, and what are they making, $500 a month, right? Which is what they're going to pay a Cambodian, which is probably a little bit more than they would pay just another Cambodian who doesn't speak English. But they were thinking, wait a second, the NGOs are paying $2,000 for some of these folks. So that was a challenge. So they're not getting the best jobs coming right out, but at 23, who really does? I mean, this is a challenge, right? So multiple realities that they had to struggle with. The bigger question was, initially they said, study whatever you want, right? Well, I don't know how much money you make being an English or, you know, a humanities major at an undergrad, so this is a challenge. And then students would want to do something that was service-oriented. Nursing, social work, not the most high-paying jobs in Cambodia, certainly not in the United States, maybe here, I don't know, but... So those are other challenges. So were they employable? Yes, they can get jobs. And they had the networks that were in place. That was the other nice thing. They were surrogate parents, if you will, to say, I know somebody who knows somebody, we can get you a job. It's going to pay, again, $500-$600, you know, US. Not too bad if you're in Cambodia, but not what they would necessarily want. And so there's that level of expectation, I think, that they need to work on. The organization did change in that regard. They said, if you're going to go to the United States, here are majors that you need to consider. And that gets complicated, too. Now, that was interesting because, well, gosh, I have lots of nieces and nephews who have arguments with their parents about what they can major in. So that was normal. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, some organizations are saying, you can't tell them what to major in. That's, you know, just because you're paying for it. I'm like, well... A lot of parents who have that conversation with their kids. Say, well, I'm paying for your tuition, so here's what you're going to study. And we do the same kind of conversation interventions with families that we would do here. We're like, well, let's find a balance.
Do they look into... Sorry, I have another question. Do they look into the cost of sending a few students overseas versus having lots of students locally trained? Because I wonder the benefits of that and being locally trained and then going to a system that... You've been trained to work in.
The organization has evolved and changed, and I think they're in a better place now.
Yeah.
Initially, again, if you're all from North America and all from the United States, you think the best education is from the United States.
Yeah.
It turns out there's a lot of South Koreans who live and do business in Cambodia, and if you ask them what colleges, they'd say, oh, you should go to South Korea. So that's pretty normal, right? But in fact... There is some discussion about, is there a benefit to sending them all the way to the United States for university? It costs a lot more, first of all. Right? So that's why they started moving to Thailand, maybe Malaysia, and you know, the globalization of higher ed is fascinating, that they, if it's in English and the instruction is English, why not send them to these institutions? It was an oversight for the organization because they didn't know of any institutions in Southeast Asia. And not knowing and then hearing about it, not valuing it, was a challenge. Let's narrow it down to say, well, why not just stay in Cambodia, like you're suggesting, right? Part of the challenge, even in Cambodia, is you could go to a really good, which this school had become, a very good private international school. But because it was an international school, the students were not eligible to take the national examination. They have a national examination system in Cambodia. You have to pass that. Again, part of the problem is there's ways to pass it with a fee. And so a lot of students can do that. But if you want to take the up and up and be, ethical, we're not going to do that. Well, they were, by nature of having graduated from a non-registered school, ineligible to take the examination. And then, exacerbated by the fact that they couldn't speak Khmer well enough to take the national examination. So, again, these are things that they need to work on and try to resolve. My two cents on this is, if they were able to do catch-up school in elementary to get them at grade level, you could do something similar post-baccalaureate with language and culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly with language, that they would be able to learn the language. And it's not like they couldn't speak it. They just weren't as fluent as they could be when you're 22 years old and have only lived in Cambodia.
Yeah.
So, thank you for your question.
Okay.
Please ask more.
I have more, but I'll ask.
Alex, is there any movement towards employing locals in that international school kind of setting for the sake of the language?
Yeah.
And the culture, rather than simply bringing in internationals to do the heavy lifting, to speak?
Yeah. That's a good question. It actually broadens the discussion to what makes the school successful. And at a certain point, it's revenue generating, and they want to keep the numbers. And so what sells, and again, this could be another topic for another time, is the soft power of having internationals at the school. So having Americans, they didn't have as many Australians. Primarily it was American, North Americans, Canadians, who were teaching at the schools. And that was a big selling point. I've heard this while I was in Cambodia, that nobody wants to go to Filipinos to learn English in Cambodia. And they speak a lot of English in the Philippines. But nobody wants to go to the Filipinos because they didn't want the Filipino accents. Right, they wanted real English. It's funny for me to say that in Australia, because real English means American English to us, right? Who is the queen? Yes. So that's our challenge, I think, is to say, well, if you were to employ locals, first of all, you absolutely would have this dual language, and then I think it's beneficial for international students from North America to be at these schools and learn Khmer in these schools. Mm-hmm. One of my disappointments, I think, is my children lived there and they didn't learn the language as well as they could have. Mm-hmm. It was one class that they took a semester, as opposed to having it sort of a dual language immersion.
Yeah. I think in Australia there are experiments in dual language immersion. I think there are schools, in private schools in Victoria, where the kids are getting half their week in Mandarin and half their week in English.
Yeah.
And the kids are coming out 100% bilingual.
Yep.
So it's kind of happening around the place, but I don't know if it's happening in WA yet. I'm not aware of
it. And they are experimenting now with having Khmer, not just in the classroom, but mandating sort of extra classes after school, before school, and making it required. I think that's the right direction they need to go, especially if you're working with Cambodian students.
I've got a question. In regards to the 10 students that came, that graduated from college and came back, have any of them indicated a desire to return to the country that they did their college in? I mean, there's similar systems in like Malaysia and Singapore where the government sponsors their students to go to Australia to study, and a lot of them want to defect to Australia and not return back to Singapore and Malaysia. So,
I was wondering if the tension. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there was a lot of tension, to be honest. Because they love the United States, they love their experience, and all their friends, and they made their new networks, and to pick up and leave and to go back to Cambodia. partially, I think this is another discussion of identity. It was a challenge for them because it was objectifying, really. It just became, and when they had to go give these talks for the scholarships, right, people wanted to hear their stories, right? My challenge as I talk about this research is, am I also not objectifying them and telling their stories over and again? But their identity is not simply that they are orphans, right? That's everybody else's reality upon them, that they're disenfranchised youth. They don't necessarily see themselves that way. Especially when they're in the United States, you know, where it was a little bit more egalitarian and they didn't have to tell everyone that they were, you know, they came from this background. They were just Cambodian international students. And their friendships and their networks, etc., they wanted to stay. The reality for them is they had a student visa and they needed to come back. So if they wanted to go back, they would have to do it on their own. They had no real networks. That was a reality for some of the students. They realized, I want to go back, but I realize the difference between me and my American friend who has the blue passport. He or she can go back and forth all they want. I have to go back to Cambodia. If I decided to stay, and one student got married and wanted to stay in the United States. And it was hard for the organization because they wanted this person to come back. Eventually she did. They got married and they came back to Cambodia because they both wanted to live there. But she came back as a U.S. citizen, which is interesting. Yeah. Oh, there's some like heartbreak stories in there with one student fell in love with another student from India, also an international student. They both had to go back to their home countries. I mean, that was heartbreaking. And how do you reconcile some of that? So not unlike a lot of international students. I would imagine the same thing could be true here. Mm-hmm. So those are ongoing challenges for international students. We got a guy running for president in the United States who really wants to get rid of everybody. and some who are legally residents. We just look illegal. That's what the problem is. But anyway, it's an ongoing challenge.
I'm interested to hear about your perspective as a parent, having your children.
Yeah.
Because presumably they came from a comfortable lifestyle in the US to Cambodia,
yeah,
which is very different.
Yes.
And then went to school with the Khmer children.
Yeah.
So what was that like for them? And you know, how did your wife and yourself reconcile, like, the 3 years that you were there?
Yeah.
And then what did you have to do, if anything, to bring them to US standard when you went home again? Would you?
Yeah. Well, I could talk about privilege. It's a deeper level. We were talking about that earlier, Sue. This idea of privilege that is just embodied, first of all, by choice. And I want to say every single person that I worked with who was from the United States, as much as they may have felt called to a certain place, had the privilege of choice of going there. And as much as they, you know, they were paid very little to teach there, these North Americans, and they could make a lot more anywhere else. But as you talk to people in Cambodia, you say, yeah, I don't have a lot of money. And their first response is, how did you get here? So I bought a plane ticket. How much did that cost? Oh, I don't know, $1,200 US. They're like, how in the world did you get $1,200? And it's a round trip ticket. So, you know, that's 3 years' wages, right? So this is the thing that you realize very quickly that I tried to share with my children, my own children, to say, we are coming from an incredible place of privilege. So that's the first level. And then this objectification to say, oh, Cambodians are all orphans, or they're all poor, and everywhere we went, there were children begging in the streets, and so they said, those are Cambodians, and they're all poor. And so to disassociate that, and it was pretty easy because they were very, very rich Cambodians. You know, someone who's driving a Range Rover, $60,000, $100,000 Range Rover, I couldn't afford that. And so they learned very quickly, oh, not all Cambodians are poor. If they're rich, they're filthy rich. They could own us. So, yeah, what was missing was the middle class. And so trying to get them to understand that there's got to be a... for them to hold on to sort of two realities, which I think was really helpful. I will say, when we went back to the United States, they were behind academically. The school was a, you know, it was a good school, but we live in an area with a good school district that is very competitive, and so they were behind initially. Two of them were caught up. One likes being behind, so that's fine. We're working on him for some other motivation things. But yeah, that was a challenge, I think. And again, we went in, my wife and I went in. She does a lot. She's a pharmacy professor, a licensed pharmacist. So she did a lot of medical work there. And she obviously has a different lens. And she says, you know, it's nice that you're doing all this stuff with education, but healthcare.
Yes.
We just want them healthy. there are diseases that Cambodian citizens are struggling with that we don't have in the United States anymore because of preventative medicine. So it's a different perspective. So, but thank you for asking that question, because I think we still come back and we're right back into the rat race of living in North America. And we forget very quickly.
Yeah, thanks.
I was just going to say, despite all these, you know, there are obviously negative consequences to it, what is the alternative? Like, what else can you do if you don't do this?
That's right.
Yeah.
You're talking about the schools that they're established.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
Yes.
I think the biggest, and this is a very subtle difference, I think, is organizations that come in and think, I'm going to do work in spite of the existing system. Right, or work against the system exacerbates the problem. And so there has to be this level of partnership to think, how do we, and this is what's going on with the anti-human trafficking organizations, NGOs that go in, not just Cambodia and other countries, you're not working with the government. And dangerous assumptions and, you know, objectifying leadership to say, all of this government is corrupt, and that's just not true. You have to work within a system. And, you know, I like to say this because I'm here in Australia. I'm like, hey, you're driving on the wrong side of the road. Says something about my assumptions of normativity, right? To say, oh, why is this like this? I mean, Cambodia is this way, that way. It's not right or wrong. It's different from what your experiences are. Find the middle ground. And this is why I love the work, and hopefully the future that we can collaborate with the center is we both care about the same thing, but we come at it from different perspectives, and we have a lot of our own cultural lenses and baggage, if you will, of the way we view the world. And we just assign right and wrong to it. And there isn't. So it's being able to hold on to, what is it, F. Scott Fitzgerald is famous for saying, the test of a first-rate mind is to hold on to two seemingly contradictory thoughts at the same time and still being able to function, right? And I think collectively that's what we need to figure out in a place like Cambodia and other global south. Yeah.
One more?
No.
Any other questions?
I wanted to, I'd be remiss if I didn't introduce my colleague here, Joe Slavens, who now lives in Perth, but he's, we've worked together on research, and we're pursuing some different research, and then will keep us, hopefully, here in Perth and in Australia. But Joe's finishing his PhD right now. We're working together, and we're doing other research, but it's, we're doing stuff on equity and diversity, which is not necessarily connected to this, but it's all sort of tied together. So it's a privilege again to be here. Thank you so much for coming, the gift of your time to come here and listen to this and to interact together. So thank you. Thank you again for the invitation. And it's been great.
Very welcome. Could you join me in thanking Alex?
Thank you.